Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Horror Hangout podcast, where three bearded film fans watch the best and worst horror movies of all time. My name is Luke Condor with Kate, and I'm joined by my regular co-host, Mr.
Ben Errington.
And also our increasingly regular co-host, Mr.
Andy Conduit Turner. Hello, guys.
How are we doing?
Hello.
Good. Very good.
Are we all good? Are we all isolating?
Oh, completely isolated. Yeah.
Completely isolated. Are we all on lockdown?
Yeah.
It is weird. As time goes on, do you feel like you're getting more used to it, or do you feel like it's becoming more bizarre?
I actually had to drive into the office on Friday, and that felt weird, getting out of the house and like seeing people, because there's still people out and about.
Yeah, it doesn't seem... The thing is, people aren't staying at home enough for it to be completely dead when you go out there.
There's more people, because I live like, about. Quite like a rural area, there's more people out in the woods now than there is ever.
Yeah.
Like... when I normally go take the dog and stuff like that.
Best thing is, because everything is closed, so people who have gone somewhere can't go anywhere to do a thing now, so they just go into...
All those people who just go to the woods and get nude. You can't just go nude anymore.
Exactly.
I'm in a weird space where, like, it is nice to see people, and I'm finding, you know... I'm doing more calls on video and talking to that way. And when I'm out and about, when I see people, when I am out with the dogs, if I see someone on the other side of the road, I like wave and say hello and I'm friendly. But then I had to go to Tesco's the other day and... Excuse my French, guys. Those fucking arrows on the floor for one way are massive. They're massive one-way arrows. And stupid dickhead still walked the wrong way. So everyone's on notice now. I'm going to buy extra cans of beans and stuff as I go around Tesco. Not for panic buying, but so I can throw them at people that go the wrong way down those one-way aisles. Because
I've never heard you swear before, I don't think.
Oh. I never have. That was the first time.
That was the first time.
That was the first time. I didn't feel.
I had to Google the meaning of the swear words, the meaning of it. And I hope I used it appropriately for the absolute...
Going into supermarkets are genuinely terrifying experiences now. Like, I don't think I'm being paranoid, but I'm just being like, just please. Like before, I always used to think, get away from me, but now I feel like I can actually say it. Yeah. Just get away from me! Two meters?
I would keep that forever. If people could stay 2 meters away from me at all times, unless they have a formal invitation, that'd be fine. I could live with that.
A formal invitation.
Can you imagine how much nicer nightclubs would be when they open again?
Okay?
If things go to a nightclub, just go to the bar. A little 2 meter exclusion zone there. Have a little lean.
The only reason I don't like going to bars anymore is because someone always spills a drink on me, every single time.
You have got one of those faces
that you want to spill a drink on. That guy looks too dry.
You look very dry.
Way too dry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So today we're doing a slightly different episode. We're doing a sort of triple bill of games rather than a single bill of movie. I guess, how are we going to do this? So, do you want to talk about what we've watched first, or some news first, or?
Yeah, well, I got a couple of bits of news, so okay. Nothing too intense, but films being pushed back, films getting new release dates. So Candyman, the Candyman sequel, that's coming out on September the 25th now. So that was going to come out in June. So a few months extra to wait for that. Do you think September is achievable for cinemas to be open again? Because I saw like Mulan got pushed back to July, and I almost feel like that's not long enough.
That doesn't feel long enough, yeah.
I think they can just, especially now, so many cinemas are digital distribution and so on. I guess with the except, if they push back on their print marketing and so on, do you reckon they're just looking for, I guess it's a gamble, right? Because if you're one of the first films that come back into the cinemas and you get it in nice and early, then you're going to be fairly uncontested. So you'll get a good slot there, but maybe people are just taking a gamble of, I'll put a date that's as early as we can get it. We get an open slot, and then we can always push back again if they need to.
I mean, just the whoever manages like Odeon's calendar, like I don't know how, because surely all these spots are all booked up already. Like people are paid for screening their film for 2 weeks from then or whatever. I mean, how is this working?
I guess studios are going to just move stuff around. I guess, like, if it's one studio that have got a film booked for September, but then their film that was supposed to come out in March can't, then they're probably moving things around.
I think they've just got like the Disney block. They've blocked those weeks for Disney movies so they can switch them around.
It's fairly unprecedented for everyone, right? But I know the Marvel movies have all sort of they've basically knocked back one. So Black Widow is now in the slot they were going to release Eternals, and then so on and so on and so on.
So the other one is that A Quiet Place, which obviously was going to come out pretty much the week before everything really did hit the fan for the UK and the US, is now been moved back to September the 4th. So that's Labor Day weekend. Don't know if that means we're going to get that on at the same time in the UK, maybe. So obviously they don't want to go video on demand with this because it made a lot of money in the cinema, didn't it?
I'm suspicious then, though, when it comes to like these movies that are definitely in the horror wheelhouse. Do you reckon it is based around that Labor Day weekend and the holidays that exist in the US? Because it feels kind of strange to have like an autumn film that then you're within spitting distance of Halloween. Do you not push it for a little bit longer?
Yeah, it's all pretty messed up, really, isn't it? I don't know what's going on. So the other news, obviously, which is quite disappointing, is that The Last of Us Part 2 has been delayed indefinitely, which I guess is strange because you'd think people would be buying.
What do you mean? What?
Yeah.
How?
What?
Do you mean the game? They're just not gonna. It's not ready yet. Or.
So no. Well, apparently, it's for the same reason. They're in the midst of fixing final bugs. And then they're faced with reality that due to logistics beyond our control, we couldn't launch The Last of Us 2 to our satisfaction. So it's probably like...
Or the physical stuff.
They're probably well up against it to release it in May. And because of everything that's been happening, it's affected things in a way. So they've just had to delay it.
You may as well, though. I think if people are expecting things to be delayed now anyway, you know how things are with games and so on in particular, coming out with massive day one patches and, you know, having to do... Like, if you... are given an opportunity, really the situation we have globally now is carte blanche to like delay something if you really want to.
There could
be those reasons outside their control, but equally this could be a good opportunity to say that and they get more dev time on it.
That's true.
And then with a new console launch right around the corner.
Exactly. That's what's true. Yeah, possibly. The original Last of Us came out right at the tail end of PS3 as well, didn't it? So they'll probably release it on PS4, but then there'll be a remaster on PS5, which seems mad to try and think about a new game being remastered, possibly in a couple of years, but who knows what the PlayStation 5 is going to be able to achieve. And the other thing game-related is that I saw there was more rumors surfaced involving Resident Evil 8, which apparently is going to be a first-person game. Probably going to have Ethan as the main protagonist again. heard random rumors that there's going to be like hallucination and insanity segments, as well as enemies based on mythical creatures, including werewolves. Apparently, there's going to be a snowy village segment.
Oh, Resident Evil.
I've heard huge departure. I've heard a massive departure that will really upset some people. Why would you do something that would?
The thing is, if they've only released one of the games in first person, it seems like, you know, that's a successful sort of departure already. Why not just stick to that and just go, right, okay, well, the next two games, Resident Evil 8 and 9, are also going to be like that. Almost, so you've got like a contained trilogy of them then.
Wait, so it's going to be first person.
Allegedly.
Cool. Yeah. I'm happy about that. I want more of those kind of games.
I'm willing to go with them and see what they've done. I played through 6 and I'm still coming back for them. So, you know what? I'll see what they've got for me for 8. I'll stick by them.
Yeah. I like the differences. I like the departures, and I think that there's always something in all of the games that I kind of latch onto and enjoy. So,
yeah,
looking forward to it. Okay, that's that in terms of news. Unless anybody else has got anything.
No, just a few films I've seen. Who wants to go first?
You go for it, Luke. I reckon you're gonna have the biggest list.
You got some stuff going on.
Well, I think Andy, we watched this one. Together, sort of, digitally. We watched Tremors.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I think I've talked about it on this podcast before. I've seen it many times now. We had like a little Hawk and Cleaver watch party on Facebook. Everyone watched the film and were commenting along as we were watching it. It's maybe the perfect film for that environment. Just watching it with friends. I mean, it's funny. It's doesn't take itself seriously at all, but it's... I also really like the creatures, and I really like the concept. And you know, Kevin Bacon, you can't go wrong with Mr. Bacon.
Yeah, the reason I didn't join you for that is because I watched it very recently, and I think I've watched it maybe like 2 or 3 times in the last few years as well. So
it's definitely a good film to leave watch it with. I need to leave it for a while now, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, you go, Andy. You go next.
No, like literally the only real watching I've had, I think, like we were talking just before we kicked off today, I've watched Tremors in the horror world. But apart from that, I've mostly been playing games when I've had the downtime recently, or Disney Plus came out over in the UK a couple of weeks ago as well. So I've just had endless binges of like Simpsons, really. All just that and Tiger King.
Oh, Tiger King.
Oh, yeah. We discussed Tiger King on last week's episode, didn't we? I've heard something that there might be like another episode dropping soon, which is kind of like a roundup or what everybody's up to now.
Well, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could be interesting.
What about you, Ben?
So I watched... This was kind of like a bit of a comfort film, comfort food scenario. I watched the Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because... I realised I hadn't like watched them in a few years, and I hadn't reviewed them on Letterboxd as well. And I kind of, that was a big glaring omission. I thought, I've got to get my Spider-Man reviews in there. And in terms of horror, because obviously it's Sam Raimi, there are a few sequences which are really reminiscent of The Evil Dead. There's one particular sequence in Spider-Man 2 when Dr. Octopus is being Doc Ock is being there's like surgeons trying to remove his arms. And basically, it's like that scene. They've just gone, okay, well, basically, we're going to make this. This is like an Evil Dead scene. And there's like the first person of the arms, and there's like a chainsaw. Yeah. And there's just like some really over-the-top, ridiculous things. And it is pretty scary as well, actually. People are getting slung around, and yeah. But yeah, great, absolutely great films. I don't actually hate Spider-Man 3. I think it's got a lot going for it.
I think it gets a bit cheesy, and it's like a bit Batman and Robin towards the end. But like, there's some good stuff in it. It's just
there's some cringe fest stuff.
It gets a bad rap. Like if you take the dancing,
I like the dancing bit.
Like I love that bit because the whole point
in the jazz
is that
club.
He's meant to be a real piece of shit, and it's meant to be cringy and funny because he's just. Yeah. But he's very confident. I think my only problem with Spider-Man 3 is really Venom didn't need to be in it. They basically rushed it on through, didn't they? And it didn't go well because of it.
The Sandman scene, you know, he's like rebuilding himself.
Yeah, that's
all very Sam Raimi.
I think Spider-Man 1 is really, really good, really solid. Spider-Man 2 is probably the best superhero movie, I think, simply just for some of the thematic stuff and the fight sequences. I've noticed that the first film's full of puberty metaphors. The second film is full of erectile dysfunction metaphors. There's so many times where he just like something doesn't quite work and he's like, what's bloody happening to me?
It never usually happens. Do something sexy, Doc Ock. Do something sexy. Stop talking about your ex.
Yeah. So I would go as far as giving Spider-Man 2 the big 5-star treatment. I think it's near perfect. And I enjoy Spider-Man 3 as well. So that's been fun. James Franco as well. Like, I think he's an unsung hero of these films because when he really needs to, he can dial it up. Like, he's just like the best friend for like the first film, and the second film he's like the sort of douchey Oscorp guy who's got a chip on his shoulder for Spider-Man. So many times that Peter could just have said, "I didn't kill your dad." But he doesn't. Oh, no. He kind of just goes, kill him. Well, maybe.
And also, something the butler could have said something a while ago. I wasn't going to say anything, but now it's come to this.
How Green Goblin killed himself? Where he got impaled?
Got a glider in the dick.
He got what? A glider directly. He got impaled by his glider in the dick. It's not his stomach. It's not his chest. It's directly into his dick. Directly into his dick.
That's one of the things that Spider-Man 1 does almost contest in, because Willem Dafoe is so good as the Green Goblin. He's so good. And then James Franco does channel a bit of his face in the third one. You know, Reese told you've got to break up with Mary Jane, otherwise I will kill her. And then he's having a coffee with her. He looks at him over the road like...
Yeah. Oh, that's a good fan. Honestly, if you haven't seen them recently, just go back and watch them again, because they're gifts that keep on giving.
Do you regret that we never got to see his fourth one with Bruce Campbell as Mysterio?
Yeah, definitely. And apparently, was it John Malkovich as Vulture, potentially?
That would work.
I think I heard that as a rumour then. I do regret it, because I love everybody involved in these films, and I just love the vibe of them. I love the Danny Elfman soundtrack. I just love the way New York is portrayed. It's amazing.
Whenever we get one of these things that didn't play off, like, and I know these things cost money and time to make the same as a thing does, but you know, maybe slightly less millions. I'd love to see a full like graphic novel at very least of what that script would have been like, or you know, the same of like, you know, the Tim Burton Superman that never happened. I'd love to see these things fully fleshed out with visuals as to how they would have been.
They did that with Alien 3, like the original script.
It's an audio drama now as well, isn't it? It's on Audible, isn't it?
Yeah. So maybe. Never
very
know.
Cool. Anything else?
Yeah.
Anything else anybody has seen?
Watched a couple of things. Well, I watched a bit more Swamp Thing, which is still really good. It's lost some of the sort of out-and-out horror moments. It's gone a bit more X-Files, Monster of the Week sort of style now. Mm-hmm. But it's still good. But also I watched The Platform on Netflix, which a lot of people have been talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen Andy?
No, not yet. I will watch it. I've added it to my list, but it's not one I can have on the background because I'm going to have it with the subs.
If you can imagine a film that's maybe the halfway point between Cube and Snowpiercer, it's pretty much that. So the idea is a guy, he signs up because he's going to get a certificate. He goes in something called the Hole. Yeah, it's like a certificate. He's going to help him get a job or something. But no one really knows what the Hole is or what happens in there. So he goes to sleep and he wakes up and he's on this like bare bones prison cell with one other guy, like an older guy, and there's like a hole in the middle of the room, and if you look up, you can see hundreds of more platforms above you, the two people on each one above and two people down below. And I think he wakes up and he's like on the 39th floor or something like that, and you find out that like every day a big tray of food comes down down through the hole, and it gives them like 2 minutes to grab what they want to eat, and then goes further down. So there's enough food at the top for everyone, but the people at the top scoff their faces, and there's always like less and less food as it gets to the bottom. So the people in the bottom have to resort to like cannibalism and violence and stuff to try and get the food. It's like a metaphorical thing about greed and politics and capitalism and everything like that. But I love that kind of thing. It gets a bit weird. Like sometimes the metaphor is very heavy-handed when it's like it against the story logic within the film, just to kind of hammer home the political side of it. But it's still great. It's got some lots of violence, lots of cannibalism, lots of gross food. It's in Spanish, so that might put some people off. People have been watching the dubbed version and they've said it's a bit annoying. I watch the subtitle version.
I watch the subtitles. That's why I've got to wait. I've got to wait until I can sit and not be distracted. Like, I know living a terrible life, isn't it? But, like, you know, sometimes there are films that you can watch that you're going to be on your phone at the same time, or you'll also do something else. And I'm just looking for a window when I can just sit, and that'll be the only thing I'm doing.
Well, so I do have a habit of getting on my phone and stuff, but I didn't really get my phone out at all. This really, really held my attention. It's
oh, cool.
It's fantastic, really. It's probably a solid 4 out of 5. It's along that sort of
nice
level. Yeah.
Nice.
Very nice.
Anything
else?
Yeah, one other thing I watched is the new Pixar film, Onward.
Oh, yeah. I watched that too.
What did you reckon?
A couple of weeks ago. I really liked it. Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
I like the world.
I saw a Guardian review that said it's finally Pixar are back. It's the best Pixar film made in 10 years. And I was just thinking, you know that meme where I can't remember his name, the guy in Guardians of the Galaxy says, am I a joke to you? I was picturing that and the Coco film. Because Coco is so good. Coco is like maybe my favorite Pixar film. Like it's better than Onward, I reckon. Both of these films, Onward and Coco, really get you in the feels at the end. Coco more so for me, but it's lovely. Onward is a really lovely Coco film.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Another film I watched this week, this being the last one I say, is a Ridley Scott film from the 80s with Michael Douglas called Black Rain. I don't know if you guys have ever seen this.
No, I never heard of it.
It's set in Japan. It's like a neo-noir action. It's like a neo-noir action thriller. This film is so good. This is like one of the coolest films that I've seen in a long time. Like in terms of film I've never seen before. I happened to watch a YouTube video about it, and I kind of thought, okay, I'll watch that. I'll stop watching YouTube video. I'll watch this film, and it's really good. Michael Douglas is like a rogue New York cop. There's like Yakuza. There's like a love story. There's a Hans Zimmer score, which isn't like orchestral. It's like just a really classic 80s score, synthy stuff. Really, really great film. Yeah, the way Japan is kind of is shown as well is really cool. It does feel a bit Blade Runner-y in places. Obviously, it's after that film. But yeah, if you've never seen it before, which you guys said you haven't.
Speaking about games and Blade Runner, did you see that Hideo Kojima game? It's like a massive Blade Runner ripoff. It's before Metal Gear Solid, I believe.
Police Nauts?
No, let me have a
it's like Snatcher or something.
Snatcher. Yeah, I think Snatcher. That's it. Or maybe it's not. Can you have a Snatcher? Yeah, no, it is, yeah. So it's a huge ripoff. Apparently it's a great game to play though. Apparently it's really fun.
Okay, so it's like a Genesis game, like a what was it, 16-bit, 8-bit?
Sega Saturn. That on PlayStation, apparently. I'm sure you can get it.
It looks super, super violent as well.
Yeah. I need to play this.
Very cool. Yeah, there we go. Anything else anyone wanted to talk about before we go into the meat of today's episode?
All good.
No.
All
good. Thank you.
All good.
Cool. So we're going to talk about horror in video games. About a few recent releases, but also a game that we all played fairly recently as well. I guess before we get into it, what started everyone's love affair with horror and video games? What was the first thing you played?
I don't think I had a love affair with it for a long time. I was terrified of horror games for the most part of my life.
There we go.
It's only recently. I remember there was an Alien game for the Amiga or the Mega Drive. It's like a platformer. You play. It's got to be Alien 3 because Ripley had a head shave. Do you remember
Alien
that game?
Alien 3, yeah. Okay. Alien 3.
So me and my friends used to, I mean, we would have been very young, 6 or 7. We used to get infected or die. Like the alien gets you And then there's like a countdown, like a continue menu.
Like a timer, yeah.
And she's like against the wall.
I remember that.
And it counts down for 10 seconds. And then if you don't continue, the alien chest burster comes out. We used to put that on over and over and over again and jump and scream as the chest burster popped out. Like repeatedly. Yeah. And then my cousin Dan would play Bring Resi 1 around, and I pretend I was watching him play, but I wasn't watching him play. I was just terrified. I don't know why.
Looking at the floor.
Looking at the floor. What's going on here? What kind of shag is this I'm stood on? Bloody lovely.
I just found him so, so terrifying. I think it was only... I mean, I had a friend once who bought me Dead Space because he knew I liked horror stuff. Didn't play that. And I felt really bad about it because I played like the first bit, and then it's like not a Xenomorph, but what do they call those things in Dead Space?
Necromorphs.
Necromorphs,
yeah.
It chases you out of this first hallway, and I had to pause it and go, yep, I can't play this. So it took me a long time to get to the point where I could play horror games. I'm trying to think what the first... I mean, there was a few here and there. I think Silent Hill 4, I managed to stomach and get through.
The Room?
Yeah, yeah.
That was good.
Yeah. But it was only recently...
I think I played a few games like on the Mega Drive, which had like horror elements. But I think the first time I got into it was with Resi 1, which I got for my birthday, I think, and I just absolutely loved it. But I couldn't play it without somebody else in the room. Somebody else had to sit like with me while I played it.
Yeah.
Alien Trilogy on PS1 as well was one of them,
yes.
Which was pretty damn terrifying. Obviously, like the original Doom and stuff. I remember having that on PC, and yeah, being pretty scared of that. Same with you, Andy. Was that kind of where you started?
For me, I think Resident Evil, the original on the PlayStation, was definitely a big milestone. Doom, I remember having the shareware version on, you know, the 3.5-inch floppy disk that you just got the first chapter on. But I think, and I'll have to check, this is all within the same rough period of time when these things all started. I think one of the first and strongest games that I recognised as horror, because Doom was one of those things, they were monsters, but I didn't necessarily think of it as a scary thing because I was a kid playing it. So I put cheats on and I wasn't playing it properly necessarily. But the thing I first remember really picking up as a horror game, maybe even pre-Resident Evil, certainly because it's pre-PlayStation, was my cousin had Night Trap on the Mega CD. I didn't have a Mega CD, but I played it round at his... You can get it on the Switch now. Yeah, it's the one that's the full motion video. It was Night Trap.
Oh, yeah.
Night Trap and Mortal Kombat was what made the rating system official for, you know, the BBFC officially for games came in.
Yeah.
And it was one of these things that were up in court hearings about them being terrible. If you look back at it now, it is schlocky as you like, and it isn't. And like you, Luke, I remember watching it round at my cousin's house, and there's a bit with one of the... they're like men in bin bags, but they're like vampires. there's one in the shower, hiding in the shower cubicle, and it comes out and gets this girl who's gone into the bathroom, and he I think he like attacks her with what looks like a litter picker that a park keeper might have, you know, for picking up rubbish without having to bend down.
Yeah,
and I've watched it back recently, and it is, compared to, like, you know, everything we see now in movies and everything, it is nothing. You can have this on a children's television program now, because a woman walks into a bathroom fairly much fully clothed and then is pinched by a bin bag man. I think now you'd consider that mild peril, but at the time, I remember I went back to my cousin's house and I was like, oh, that was scary, I had to look away. But then there's like a fascination with it, and then Resident Evil came out. I got it with my PlayStation, I think, when I got one, and we got on from there, really. I remember having like people around and sort of co-op playing it. That was like the thing with horror games.
I feel like you guys have been more... You have to let me know. Are you more hardened to the like game scares, like when you play like Resident Evil 7? When I played that recently, I found I had to really sort of... I had set myself a timer. I was like, I've got to play for 25. I have to push forward for 25
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if I'm hardened to it, because even playing Resident Evil 3, which I played and finished just a few days ago, I was sweating and I'd like proper felt like my heart racing, and I was like stressed by it. And I think I still enjoy that. And that's why I keep going back to horror games, because I still do enjoy that stress of playing something, that urgency of like, right, let's get somewhere safe. Let's get to the next bit. Okay, well, there's a quiet bit here where I've got to find some items and I don't really have to worry about fighting any monsters. And now it kind of happened with, like, I played...
Well, I was going to say, now that I understand that, like, drug now, like, now I'm a bit older and I'm starting to play them, that... Because not many games make you feel quite like that. Like, there is a thrill to it. It's fun. Yeah, it's really good.
And I think it's the same reason why people enjoy horror movies, you know? It's that, is that thrill, that thrill of just being terrified and just... And I think there's something about a jump scare in a game which kind of just feels more inclusive. Like a jump scare in a film, sometimes I feel like the film's trying to make me feel scared, but I feel really included in the jump scares for games.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I've played Resident Evil. I've really enjoyed stuff like Silent Hill. Played some other horror games from like the PlayStation 1 and 2 era, like Parasite Eve, Haunting Ground.
Haunting Ground.
Clock Tower. Haunting Ground. Clock Do you remember Tower. Haunting Ground?
Haunting Ground and Clock Tower as well. Clock Tower 3 on the PlayStation 2 has some great voice work in it. When I say great, I mean awful, but it's great.
Haunting Ground, I just borrowed that off somebody. But now Haunting Ground on PS2 is like going for like 100 quid on eBay.
I used to have a copy of that, sold it for significantly less than 100 quid. Fuck.
And also like Dino Crisis, which obviously was like a Resident Evil clone in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've really enjoyed things throughout, you know, the PlayStation 3 era. So stuff like the Dead Space trilogy, all the way up to like Alien Isolation on PS4 and... newer stuff like Outlast and Amnesia.
Now, that was one that really got me the tension as well. I think with video games in general, then I understand that feeling that you get. And I guess more so than a movie, you can get more invested into it. It's not a different, it's not to say that one is better than the other, but like I think with a video game, especially one where there is a fail state, so more so than a walking simulator where, you know, you're on a track and there's things are going to come out and make you jump like in a movie. With a game like a Resident Evil, there is that intensity to it. Like, you know, you can separate it, and in your logical mind, you know that if you get got in this game, you, sat on the sofa, are going to be fine. But there is that investment that you're in control of what's happening with this character, and you have the tension of, in a Resident Evil game, those dwindling resources, and have you got enough to get you through the next encounter? Or you've got a... Alien Isolation. Oh shit! If they see me with this, this is me done for.
Yeah. Alien Isolation. Just that felt so tough. I really struggled with that finishing it because I just felt so genuinely terrified, and I just felt like it was on the precipice of being unfair. And I think the closer and closer it gets to being unfair, it's almost like the more I enjoy it, the more I'm like, I don't want to feel like this. Like with the Doom games, especially the new Doom games, you're pretty much unstoppable, you know? I mean, the difficulty gets to a certain point in the game and you feel like you can get through it, but you're pretty much unstoppable. Whereas with characters, you know, like Jill Valentine and other people, they feel very human. And you're only one green herb away from getting got, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why, especially in the new game, I was saving it pretty much every turn.
Every typewriter.
Yeah. Every single typewriter.
Yeah. With Alien Isolation and things like that, like I'm like you. I think as a combination, I was like rationing it because I found it so stressful to play. So I was doing like, it's broken into chapters, that game, wasn't it? So it was like, right, I did a chapter, and even if there was ample game time left, I was like, might go catch some Pokemon or do something nice for a while.
Yeah.
Until I got to like the very end. When I got to like the last maybe three or four chapters, I was like, I just have to sprint this now, and I just had to go for it and finish it. Like just walking through screaming. But
I really want to play this. I've never played Alien Isolation.
Oh,
I played a hacky VR version of it, but we only got to the first part of the Xenomorph bit. And I was getting it because it was like a hacked VR thing. I got really motion sick really quick because it didn't feel like it was built for that. Every time you press forward, it feels that same feeling when you know you're balancing on a chair and the chair slips back. Yeah. I was getting that exact same feeling. Yeah.
I guess the only thing I've touched on in terms of horror gaming history, did you guys ever do much in the world of like point and click stuff? Am I showing my age now with stuff like Gabriel Knight and Phantasmagoria and stuff like that?
No, I want to. There's like a few games like Day of the Tentacle and some of these big puzzle adventure games that are meant to be great. I've never played.
I'm not sure how all of them hold up these days. I know all of them fairly frequently appear on Steam. Gabriel Knight was a big one, probably even earlier than my like Night Trap memories, because they are
Broken Sword,
very, very old. Broken Sword, I never really got into. I'm not sure how much that's leading to horror and how much that's like history and mystery. Ben, you know a bit more about that.
It's not very horror at all, but you know, there's some really good, really good stuff in that point and click. Did anyone play Alone in the Dark, like the point and click?
No.
Is there a point and click Alone in the Dark?
That was like an early sort of Resident Evil-ish kind of
it was almost supposed to be like one of the birth survival horror.
There's that one, that, and then Resident Evil 1 came after that, like not long after that, right?
It's reasonably soon between them.
A few years after.
Look it up.
Yeah. So the first game I think we want to talk about, are we going with Resident 3 or...
The current recent Resident Evils, because this is a huge series, right?
Okay,
we could have an entire series on that. But Luke, you just finished 2 recently, right?
Yeah.
The remake.
Bear in mind, I've never played the originals. So this for me is like a...
Oh, wow.
It's an entry point for me, but for those games. And I'm going to get Resident 3, but I've not got around to it yet.
Yeah. There's loads of fan service in the remake, so you know, they've taken so much care and attention with certain characters that maybe were minor in the PlayStation versions, and they've included them in these remakes as well. So I think they've done really well at creating it. They've kind of like towed the line a little bit between it's still a survival horror game, but there's still the action elements are still there, but it doesn't feel like as bad, I guess, as Resident Evil 6. It feels classic.
It's got they have really struck a nice balance with it, and they've done what they can. There are still elements of the cheesy B-movie horror like lineage of original Resident Evil. You know, it's very like Romero movie, like the originals were so heavily influenced by by his movies. So And the dialogue in the first one in particular is what it was such an attraction to the series, really. But they've done in these remakes of 2 and 3, there are touches to it and there are little nods to that type of thing, but it's not purely in that. They have done a really nice job of like punching up the dialogue and making it quite modern.
Mm-hmm.
Which way around did you guys play it first? Like with Resident Evil 2 remake, did you start with Leon or Claire?
Leon, I've still not done Claire. I've got that to go through as well. Yeah,
I started with Leon. So it's weird, in Resident Evil 1, so this is obviously back in the day, I always used to do Jill originally because you started with a gun, and then I used to go and complete it again as Chris. Second one, I did Leon and then Claire, and I've never really deviated from that. You know, every time I sort of go and play it again for the first time in a while, I always kind of start the same way. And I did that with the remake as well.
I don't know. It felt like Leon was the main character to me, but I don't know if that's true.
I think in the PlayStation 1 original, I think I was very guided by which order the discs were in when you opened them, because then there was just 2 discs. And you open the box and there was a Leon disc and there was a Claire disc, and the Leon one was on the left, so that's where I started. And I think, did you play as Leon in the demo? Because I remember I had a demo disc of that I ran through hundreds upon hundreds of times as well.
Demo discs. I miss those things.
I think the 2 remake was such a triumph. And And hopefully, in the world of remakes, different company and all that, they'll manage to pull off similar with the Final Fantasy VII remake that's coming off now as well. I felt that it felt familiar enough that as someone who had really been into Resident Evil 2, I could recognise those beats and I could recognise the things that I had that nostalgia for, and I saw them again and I enjoyed them. But there was enough different that I didn't feel, oh, I've seen this, I've done this, I've... Mm. Why am I bothering with this?
There are parts that have been excluded, especially in the third game. There are some areas that have been excluded, but I wouldn't say it's to the game's detriment overall. I felt like two felt like there was the ability to explore a bit more. With three, I felt like it was a little bit linear. I felt like, you know, there were certain areas which were a little bit more open, but once you were through that area, there wasn't the opportunity to really go back. So
it
almost felt like that. And obviously with two and three, it was very much driven by the unstoppable force that's constantly chasing after you, which kind of urges you on.
Was that a big thing in the original version of two?
Now, Resident Evil 2.
Not in the original version of two, was it? No.
Okay. Yeah, in number two, Mr. X only turns up.
Why did he get the name Mr. X? Scenario.
I'm not sure if it's ever official, because he is just a tyrant prototype, isn't he? It's like T-001. But he became known as Mr. X when he was in the PlayStation version. I guess, you know, his...
It was in Scenario B, though, wasn't it? It wasn't the first scenario in Resident Evil 2.
So it only turned up in Scenario B as like an extra like tweak, because the B scenario is very similar to the A scenario, and then he was just there as an extra dimension to the story, really, wasn't he? But it would only be scripted moments.
Yeah.
So he would come in at a scripted moment, and then if you were to walk into a corridor where he'd appear,
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that you could walk out and back in again and he would have gone.
He'd be gone. And obviously they liked that element of it enough that they basically built a whole game around that.
That was one of my favourite things for the remake that I played. There's bits where you'd hear him. I mean, it's just fun. Like, it added a whole element of fun when he's chasing you around. But there were bits where you'd hear him. You know, in the main hallway in the police station, you'd hear him. Yeah. I was convinced he was around me, but then I looked over the edge of I was on the top floor, looked over the balcony, and he was down on the ground level, just messing around down there. So
you can hear his big old boots, his big hoofs. Old Dr. Martin
shooting his hat off.
great addition to the game. I thought he was more key to the original, but maybe not.
Yeah,
but
I think obviously, he's definitely thematically he was something that really stuck with people. But yeah, in terms of story wise, he has an element into the story, but he's not as essential as he becomes in this version. Sorry, Ben, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just saying, obviously, with Resident Evil 3, Nemesis is more of a key element, and I guess more of a challenge as well, because he's armed. He's got a very long arm. He's got tentacles as well, so he can grab you from a distance. So if in Resident Evil 2 you were pretty good at avoiding Mr. X, you know, because it's only when he gets close that he gives you the old knuckle sucker. But with Nemesis, he's got like a tentacle, so he can get you from afar, but he's also armed. There are two different weapons you come up against, a flamethrower and a rocket launcher. So obviously we had a rocket launcher in the original, but a flamethrower is brand new.
So that's an extra
challenge, really, to getting away from him.
It seemed to me like Resident Evil 2 was trying to not be actiony. In the sense that, like, it's trying to go for more of the creepiness, the scariness, and the sort of you have some bare bones guns and stuff. But then Resident Evil 3, from what I've seen, there's a zombie with a rocket launcher, for example.
Yeah, I mean, there are those creepy elements, but once, you know, it's not the entire game. There are a few creepy elements that are like sort of standalone or closed or little areas that relate to certain missions that you mm-hmm. need to go into. But apart from that, when you're in the city streets, it's very much just like balls to the wall. Run as fast as you can. Get away from the Nemesis. And then, you know, as the game progresses, as the game snowballs, the Nemesis gets more and more aggressive as he mutates.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think that's what I found in the... And I'm going to harken back to the originals here a little bit as well. It felt like, if you look at the Resident Evil 2 original, Mr. X was a... you know, it was an incidental thing, like another enemy that would sometimes turn up, whereas the Nemesis felt like actually an antagonist of the game, because it was very skillful at putting him in a couple of particular scenarios. And this one doesn't appear to be in the remake, where you were given a choice on screen with a prompt of what you were going to do. Yeah. Do you want to do one thing or another? One would lead you into an encounter, the other one would... and it wasn't given, it's like, do you want to... you know, do this trick or do that. It would be, do you want to hide in this place or that one? I think one of the things I remember is, do you want to run down the alley or hide in the kitchen? And if you hide in the kitchen, you're given the chance to like set off a gas explosion and knock him out and get some items from him. But
I
then,
think no matter what happens, you know, the
story
end
moves
goal,
the same.
The story moves in the same way, yeah. So mm-hmm. might be like a slight little branch off into a different scenario, but for the most part, it is the same game.
How
but,
do you feel?
You don't get
how do you feel overall with them? Are you sort of is one? Do you prefer one over the other? Are you happy with both of them so far? Are you
being fans
of the original? I mean.
I think I'm happy with them both. I think they're really, really good remakes. Or reimaginings, I guess you'd call them, rather than remakes, because they're not beat for beat exactly the same as the originals. So great reimaginings. A lot of people said they're quite short, but I guess they're quite traditional in terms of Resident Evil games as being campaigns anywhere between 3 and 6 hours. I say the campaigns usually for a Resident Evil game. Obviously, Resident Evil 7 was a bit longer. Quite a bit longer, actually, I think, wasn't it? So yeah, I think they're great reimaginings. Definitely, I'm really sort of happy. With
I think
what
it's
we've
hard.
Got.
It's hard to separate the two. I'm not quite finished with the Nemesis remake just yet. I've got a little bit further to go. But yeah, like Ben says, they can be fairly short experiences. But these games are, in a way, they are designed for you to play them again and again, and for you to get better at them. I think there's an inherent challenge. And if that's the type of thing you like, the way that you change your play style as you get more familiar with it, I think your first playthrough is usually a very methodical, saving your resources, not knowing what's coming up later. Oh, got some Magnum ammo that you hoard away and then never use. and then you play it later and you'll see there's a trophy or an achievement for finish this in less than 3 hours, or I'll unlock an unlimited weapon if I do it that fast, or will I try for those extra challenges that they built in, like trying not to open the item box or trying not to use any healing items? Mm-hmm. And it becomes less of it. Like, your first experience is that experience and the story and the horror of it. And then if you're invested in the series after that, after you've completed it once and experienced the horror, then it becomes a game that you start to mess with the mechanics on, and you start to unlock more stuff, and you start to enjoy it as a mechanical experience, as to going through and seeing how many things you can, how you can kill. I remember playing the originals and like seeing if I could kill every enemy.
Kind of want to play it again, but at the same time, there are certain sections. There's a particular section in Resident Evil 3 in a hospital, which stressed me out. it was genuinely really, really creepy. The horror elements of it were really present in that. There's a couple of new enemies as well in Resident Evil 3, which weren't in Resident Evil 2, and maybe were in Resident Evil Nemesis in a way, but they've kind of been updated, and one or two brand new enemies. So yeah, it does keep you guessing. It keeps you kind of always on the back foot.
Okay. I'm excited to play. I think I'm kind of tempted to go back and do, because there's a really good remake of number one as well, with like the painted backgrounds and whatever.
That still really holds up. Like the Resident, as in preparation for 2 coming out, the remake last year, or was it 2 years ago now? Time is slipping through our fingers.
It was last year. It was last year.
Thank God. Mm-hmm. in preparation for that, I ran through the entire series. So I did 0, which I would. That still holds up as well.
Zero is great.
That deserves a remake and more attention, because it is brilliant. And I'd imagine it's one that the smallest number of people played, because it's only on the GameCube until it came out on these current consoles. 0 is great. The remake of 1 is fantastic. 2 and now Nemesis are great as well. And then I did 4, 5, which I secretly still, not secretly, I'm about to admit it on a podcast, I love. 6 was a lot of hard work, and then 7 7 I still need to finish. I got most of the way through it, and then I got sidetracked, so I need to go back and do the ending.
I don't know if it's because I don't have the reverence growing up on the nostalgia playing Resident Evil growing up, but 7 kind of blew me away. Like, I really, really got into it, 7.
The fact that this game series has managed to like reinvent itself as many times as it has, and obviously one of the questions we had in the group was from Dan Butcher, when he said, where did the Resident Evil games go wrong and how did they course correct? I don't think they ever went really, really terribly, terribly wrong so that they could never come back from it. I think Resident Evil 5 was where it went, right, now we're an action game, you know. There's still horror elements, but we're pretty much an action game. And Resident Evil 6 obviously lent into that even more. But just everything from the lore of Resident Evil is still present. I feel like almost I can still enjoy it for what it is. And think about how huge a departure Resident Evil 4 was for the series. And a lot of people think that's the best game in the series, best game in the franchise. And the fact that it's done that...
I think that was the first Resident Evil that I played. And that was good. It was a good one. But it wasn't, it wasn't
the
a scary
is,
game.
The fact that it's done that and then it's reinvented itself again for 7 and then it's almost like half reinvented itself for the remakes as well. Like, it's just one of those... It's basically like the Madonna of horror movie games. It's reinvented itself. Yeah. What a time. Who's coming out now?
That's true, Ben. I'd agree that, like, it's... If you expected it to stay the same, and then, you know, if you are someone of very particular tastes, it could go wrong for you at a point, and then it could be something you don't enjoy anymore, or this is the one that you didn't enjoy so much. But with any Resident Evil, I think... If you were disappointed in one, you could go to another one and it would be something that would be back for you. And it's not to say that it's better or worse, unless it's Resident Evil 6, which is has some mechanic. I think Resident Evil 6, for me anyway, was a problem because I think it was very heavily designed by focus group and by board members who thought that's what people are interested in, that's what people want. Although, and don't quote me on this, I think it's one that probably has some of the highest sale numbers of the series. I think it's sold incredibly well.
Interesting. It had all of the main dudes together, right? I've not played it, so I don't know.
Yeah, pretty much. There's Leon, there's Chris, there's like Wesker's
Bertie
son.
Wesker's son,
Sherry Birkin as well. Mm. So I think if you enjoyed the games with the fixed camera angles, there's loads to play. You know, there's 4 or 5 entries to play. If you enjoy the over-the-shoulder stuff, there's loads. You know, there's 3 main entries and the Revelations games as well. And if you enjoy the first-person stuff, then obviously that's where the future of it seems to be going with the next, with Resident Evil 8 and beyond.
Revelations 2 in particular is fantastic. Have you played that, Ben?
Yeah, I've played both the Revelations games,
I enjoyed a bit of Barry, good stuff. Bit of Bazza in there.
Bit of Bazza. You'll get a big bad Bazza in there, 100%.
I guess a couple of questions then. So do either of you guys have a favourite, like, I'll give you an option, either moment, sort of set piece from Resident Evil, or monster, your favourite of the ones you've played so far?
I've not played as many, so I don't sort of have a large catalogue to choose from. But I've already said I love 7. I think I love 7 because I love the tone and the atmosphere, and I love that it's like a family of like strange people who don't seem to die. I love that concept and that idea. And I think favorite moment for me might just be that first hour. I mean, it's a long moment. The first hour of Resident Evil 7, when you're getting into the house and you're sort of walking around, you're watching the found footage tapes. It's got a bit of that element to it. And then you get knocked out, you get your arm chopped off, you have to shoot your girlfriend dead. And then the guy, I can't remember his name, the dad, knocks you out and you wake up and you're sort of tied to the chair. Yeah. And then he's sort of stalking around the house looking for you, bursting through walls. It's just an amazing first hour of that game. It's all good, but that first hour, I think, is like, you know, chef's kiss.
I think
it's so good.
I think, like, iconic wise, in terms of like the most iconic scare in Resident Evil, still holds up and is still one of the most iconic scares for me, because I remember how I felt at the time. So it was 1996. I was like, 10 years old, and it's a Cerberus dog's leaping through the window at what else felt like a really calm, nice room where you're looking for a key. And then when the Cerberus dogs leap through the window, it is one of the most moments in the original game. Okay. So I like that moment, but I also enjoyed in the Resident Evil 1 remake for the GameCube, the introduction of a character called Lisa Trevor, who had a really interesting story, and you kind of find all these various notebooks and things that kind of piece together a story. But the few encounters you have with her are genuinely like really, really quite creepy. and she's not like one of those. I mean, she's super strong, but she's not like a big. She's like a big lumbering. Do you know Lisa Trevor, Luke from games? She's kind of like obviously been experimented on, but she's got like faces sewn onto her body, and yeah,
okay.
It's really creepy. You find like this cabin where she's living just outside the mansion house. And then later on, you fight her like in a sort of underground area. It's scary stuff, man. And also the great white sharks. The fact that you get zombified great white sharks is amazing.
Yeah.
Or some form of shark, isn't it?
What about you, Andy?
Oh, it's so hard. I thought I had this pinned down, but then hearing your examples as well, there are so many great moments. The things that really spring out to me were... There's a great bit in Resident Evil 2, the original version of it, where you're in the police station and there is a two-way, you know, one of those one-way mirrors. And you run through that room so many times and you think every time something's going to come through there. And it's the time that you're not expecting it that then a licker comes like plowing through that thing. And again, yeah. I was a Resident Evil game in then and it still got a reaction out of me. Another thing that springs to mind is the Resident Evil 1, the remake. It's just twisted ever so slightly. So even as someone who is now several Resident Evil games in and you think you know it and it's a remake of one you already know, the introduction of those Crimson Head zombies into Resident Evil 1. Are brilliant, and it's another element of resources management as well, where you're thinking, okay, the only way to get, like, basically, if you haven't encountered this, Luke, and it's not a secret, it's a game that's the remake's what 20 years old now, but there are zombies that you down, but they all stay, unless you've shot the head off, then they will stay dead for a while, and then at some point they will come back to life as a Crimson Head, which is like the zombies, except they sprint and punch you in the face. They're like those 28 day later style zombies, yeah. Right, so you can get rid of them either by destroying their heads, which means you had to have got lucky with a headshot or shotgun them, or if you use your lighter and petrol you can burn them up, but you've got a limited resources of that petrol, so you have to really decide, is this a corridor I'm going to keep coming through? And unlike your Resident Evil, I'd say more so than any of them, the original is the mansion is such like a labyrinth, and you are going to be in very familiar areas quite a bit, going back and doing lots of backtracking. So making those decisions, and when you have to fight one, it is deeply, deeply unpleasant. And I think that was a real horror moment.
In Resident Evil 2 and 3, the remakes as well, you can kind of increase your inventory as you go through, but I'm pretty sure with the Resident Evil 1 remake, you've only got a limited amount of inventory slots, and you can increase them, right?
Yeah, Chris has 6, Jill has 8, I think.
Yeah, so you're carrying around this little canteen with like
and Jill has a gun,
spraying these bodies up.
Why would you be Chris?
She starts with a gun. I think with Chris, you start with a knife, but you get a gun pretty quick. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I just remembered another moment from Resident Evil 2 where you go to open a door, and with the door animation, this is from the original, the 1998 version, with the door animation, which opens, suddenly zombies appear coming towards you, like in one of the later areas. And that's another moment where they go, right, okay, you know what's going to happen in this moment. You've experienced this moment 100 times. You're probably not even paying attention, but we're just going to throw a little spanner in the works and see how you deal with it.
Well, the zombies come into the animation.
They come into the animation. They back you into the area that you were trying to exit.
There's so many moments like that where it just goes, it doesn't let you... This is a game series that never really lets you get comfortable at any point.
I have a feeling, having talked about this and get all excited about these old and new games alike, it's going to be a real struggle for us to decide which titles we're going to talk about on a follow-up to this, because now there are so many more series and more games I want to get in on. But yeah, fantastic series. And I think really, with regards horror gaming in general, there may have been things that came before, but it really is the mainstay. And you can see elements of Resident Evil in what comes next, because Devil May Cry... It probably isn't even horror, like it's a gothic action shooter, really, isn't it? But it was originally a concept for Resident Evil 4, I think, and it became Devil May Cry.
All right.
So, yeah, like, and there's so much DNA that you see from everywhere else. It goes into, you know, there's inspirations in Resident Evil that became Silent Hill, just with a different aesthetic, which then became The Evil Within, which became Dino Crisis, which became so many other things that are great games in their own right, but a lot of games that we enjoy now owe a lot to what Resident Evil started and what they continue to pioneer with what they're doing with things like 7 and in the future.
I was
going to
ask about 7. Was 7... Did 7 come out after Outlast? Was Outlast one of the first of that kind of...
I'm going to take a look for you.
Because Outlast, again, is a game I immensely enjoyed. Resident Evil 7 came out after
PT as well, and I think a lot of people thought it kind of was borrowing from that, but I think it was maybe already in production around about the time that PT came out.
I feel like a lot of indie games do that first person, like, you know, the small horror experience in first person. It's really effective. It's very effective. Okay, I mean, we could probably talk about Resident Evil forever. Did you want to sort of, should we move on to our next franchise, or should we do two and then come leave something for later on, or how did you want to do it? Because
I think if we go through Doom, which was going to be our second one, there's not as much for us to go through, right? Because I think it's story wise and story beats wise, there's not much to do it. To tell you, Luke, Outlast came out several years before Resident Evil 7.
I do wonder if they were like, this is very terrifying. We want some of that in our game. It makes sense.
I don't think it's ever been worried about borrowing from different franchises and seeing what makes things
pretty
work.
Pretty much like the Steve Jobs that of horror games. Like, just take whatever works.
Yeah.
Put a Resident Evil label on it. Exactly. Okay, yeah. So I get our next franchise, which again, I've not...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I mean, I've not really played much of until quite recently, is the Doom franchise. I think we're going to look at Doom Eternal in particular, but I think you guys have got more of a history with the franchise.
Yeah, Ben, do you want to open up?
So some of the, like, I had these games, maybe 1, 2, and 3, like in a collection that I played on PC and always really enjoyed them. But I've always kind of had a soft spot for this franchise and quite enjoyed Doom 3 as well when that came out. But obviously I think the Doom was absolutely perfected as a first person shooter in 2016 with that version of Doom, because it kind of just went, okay, this is good. We're going to add the most over the top, heavy metal, gory, colorful, ridiculous game we can. And obviously they've carried that on with Doom Eternal as well, which I haven't actually played yet, but I've seen a lot of it. And you finished it, right, Andy?
I did. I finished it off this morning.
How does it compare to the Doom 2016 version? That's the only one I played.
It's like a classic sequel to it, right? So I guess a little bit like Resident Evil. Like, Doom has been so influential to a lot of things, and it's grown as well. So Doom was maybe the first person shooter I really remember playing. I know there are, again, there are others before it, but there are some great moments in those ones. Three went into a very more slowly paced, methodical horror type thing. But Doom 2016, when it came out, I remember having quite low expectations of it because it was at the time when no review copies were released, which is usually a bad sign. You know, if no one gets any review copies before anything that's come out, it's like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to make sure that word doesn't get out this good before people, you know, hopefully it doesn't get out before anyone's put their money down. But I got it and it was fantastic. And then Doom Eternal is just Doom 2016 more so. Everything is cranked up to another level. Everything is very extreme. There's almost an arcadey feel to it that you haven't necessarily got to. It's the anti Resident Evil. In fact, you haven't got to covet your resources and hold on to things because the gameplay mechanic of Doom Eternal, more so than 16, is that you are going to run out of stuff. You are going to run dry. You can run into a fight with practically nothing because there are things that you can continue just to do to build up your items again. It's a very, very fast, twitchy gameplay, and there are actions you can take that can remediate any of your statuses that you have. So your health is going to run low, so you do those glory kills. So you do enough damage on an enemy, they flash, you click the little melee, and you get an incredibly gory animation of a monster literally being torn apart, and that spawns health for you. So you're on low health, that's how you get your health balanced. You have this item called a flame belch, which sets things on fire. While flame things belch. Are on fire, you have a little flame through your shoulder that literally belches fire. You'd use your flame belch on things, and while they're on fire, if you damage them, they spit out armor. So you do that to boost your armor up. If you're running low on ammunition for any of your weapons, you chainsaw something, and chainsawing a monster to death will have it spew out loads of ammo for your other weapons. So every encounter that you get yourself into, and it's got lots of verticality and like acrobatic movement around it as well. Typically in a Doom Eternal level, there will be some small corridors, and in each level there'll be four or five large open areas where you're going to find yourself in a firefight. And at that point you'll go in and there will be wave upon wave of enemies that come in. And what your real gameplay challenge there is that you want to keep moving around the area, because if you stand still, you will be killed. So you have to move around quickly and aggressively, and the game becomes an exercise of look for a weak enemy, shoot it, and then do whatever I want to it to make sure I get the thing I'm running low on. So do I want more armor? Do I want more health? Do I want more ammunition? Which means then you can pick out your big targets in the arena and focus on them to try and get rid of them. And they've done a lot of work in its arcadiness to give each of the larger demons that you fight particular weaknesses as well. So, you know, those big meatball demons, those caca demons that are like the big floating things. If you fire a grenade at those guys when they've got their mouth open, they will swallow it and it will blow up inside them and it will weaken them, so you can immediately glory kill them. And then you have other enemies that will run down and try and melee you that are particularly vulnerable to one weapon or another. So it's a very like frantic experience, like thinking, right, I've seen that, so now I'll switch to this weapon because that's good against this enemy. So it's a very panicked experience, and the visuals are gory and horrific. So there's the horror in that sense, but there isn't really time to be tense because it's just going. It's
I heard there's more of a story to Doom Eternal. There's more going on.
Oh, there is one.
Story-wise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. There's more going on, and it follows on pretty much directly from the end of Doom 2016. Again, I think we talked about this before we started recording. We're directly not going for spoilers on these newer games that are out, but it's Doom. There's not much story to tell. There's hell. It's on Earth. Everyone is attacking them. There's maybe some other forces at work as well. I think there's more story in Doom if you are really into it. You pick up pages of lore as you go, and you can read those files at your leisure. But to be honest, the story is delivered fairly minimally as you're going. Yeah. You'll have someone will stop and talk to you and explain what something is, but you don't really have to stop and pay attention to it. For the most part, more demons will come and you'll shoot them.
I feel like it'd be cool to do a Warhammer 40k game in this style. You're a space marine running around chaos, space marine lands or something. Yeah, I really want to play. I played 2016, and that was a lot of fun. It's,
if you enjoyed it, you'll like this. It is more of the same. I would say it just takes that extra step to being that little bit more arcadey as well.
Yeah. Okay.
It seemed like the role of like the space marine in the original Dooms, but he was just a bit of a nails, hard as nails space marine. Whereas with the Doomslayer stuff in 2016 and this one, he's almost like superhuman in a way, and I guess it explains how he tends to come like that.
Yeah, it touches on that of the story of this game as you go through, as to how he has become like this and how he has this sort of like supernatural, I guess, ability to get rid of demons and kill them off and not be killed by them. It's now a little bit deeper than it's just he's like the hardest man in the world.
He didn't say a word. He didn't say a word, right?
No, he doesn't say anything.
I think they know exactly what game they're making, and like they're just knocking it out of the park. I really want to get it. I really want to play it.
I think there's something to be said for the fact that there is no pistol and no punch in this game like there were in old Doom games. Like the first thing you pick up is your shotgun. And the first attachment you get for your shotgun is a grenade launcher. Or you can choose, actually, because you've still got that weapon upgrade system. You either choose a grenade launcher or something that makes your shotgun a fully automatic shotgun. So this is the level of things you get. And then by the time you get towards the later stages of the game, you have a dirty, great, like, mystical energy sword that can kill anything apart from like bosses in one hit. Even like the equivalent of cyber demons, you can chop in half with one slice of this sword. It's a real great balance of like you're an incredibly powerful character. So you know, this isn't like a vulnerable survival horror situation, but at the same time, you are very vulnerable. You've got an incredible destructive power behind you, but if you stand still for a second, you will be killed. So it's all about sort of a frantic action. But I'd still say it fits into the world of horror, I guess mostly because of the visual style and what it accomplishes.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on the Doom movie while we're here? Do you think it's successfully adapted? Do you think it's possible to successfully adapt it?
I haven't seen it in a long time. I kind of want to watch it again. I kind of remember thinking it was all right.
It's on Netflix.
I always like Carl Urban.
It's got like a first-person segment, isn't it?
Yeah. It has.
It was the best bit of the film, yeah. So I definitely want to watch it again. I remember enjoying some parts of it. Like The Rock is just ridiculous, right? He's like, you kind of think he suits being like Doom Guy more so than Carl Urban, but then as the film progresses, you realize why he doesn't.
More so now, because The Rock wasn't, he was always big, but like there was a certain point when he became huge in quite like a short period of time. I feel like nowadays he'd make a great Doom guy, potentially.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Although he's too kind. His eyes are too kind.
His eyes are too kind.
Kind eyes.
Your eyes are just so kind.
Okay, yeah, cool. So the last game, we are going to be talking about spoilers for this, because we were saying before we start recording, I don't think there's a way to really talk about this game without talking about spoilers, because this game doesn't even has an option where you could turn off the gameplay elements and just enjoy it as an interactive narrative experience. So the main sort of gameplay is the storytelling. And we're talking about Soma. We've talked about it before, but we never managed. we've never been able to talk about it with spoilers. So, Soma.
Going in.
Yes, Soma. When did it come out? It's 2017. Says 2015. Frictional Games. So it's the guys who made Amnesia. So they made their names for themselves doing that, and then they came out with this sort of sci-fi horror game with a similar. Similar spooky atmosphere to it, but this one is such a unique game. Is there any other game quite like Soma? or any other media quite like same. I feel like Underwater tried to capture some elements of it. But...
yeah, Underwater, The Abyss. But this was obviously, the fact that it takes place in an underwater, like, remote research facility isn't even half the story, is it?
No.
In terms of what's going on here. There's so much going on. There's, like, AI. There's, what else is there?
So it starts, it's about a guy who you start off in your normal apartment and you're looking around at photographs and all this stuff, and you've got a head injury, or you've got some sort of head problem. You've got a bad head.
You had a car accident, right? Yeah. So you had a brain injury from your car accident.
Yeah. So you go in for a scan. This new place is going to scan your brain, make like a, I don't know if they even say it's like a backup of the brain, but the next thing you know, you're still on the chair, but it's like, it's, you're very like deep underwater in a research base, but it also feels like it's gone, it's been left to rot and wither, and everything sort of doesn't quite work. It's all destitute.
And you can sort of find out fairly soon that it's a number of years into the future as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even though he went into and had a brain scan in 2021.
Yeah.
What year is it we wake up in? It's about
300-400 years later. It's like a long time later.
Yeah.
And I think you in terms of the protagonist, you really do feel his what the fuck is going on, sort of nature of everything. Like, I couldn't find myself sort of adapting to it very long. You're going around doing menial tasks and, you know, putting various areas, feeding power to them and sort of finding all these logs of people who've been down there. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? I just literally sat in a chair like 10 minutes ago. Sorry.
Yeah. So as you go through, there's like various underwater labs, and you sort of meet people as you go, and you tend to meet like robots that seem, or like robots or bits of machinery that think they're human.
Yeah, I think that's the first one you meet, right? There's a robot like and it looks not human at all. Like it's like a loader, like a forklift truck with a head.
Yeah.
And it's trapped under like some debris, and it's then, I'll go and get this person for me. I'm injured. And it's like, you have that conversation with him where you say, you're not injured, you're a robot. And he's like, not a robot, you idiot. I'm standing right here. Like, it's so surreal.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of had an inclination of what could be happening.
Yeah,
fairly early on, but there's a bit where you are in a room and it suddenly floods, and you're suddenly out in the water, and you realize you can breathe underwater. And then there's like a flashes where you see your hands; they turn from real people hands into mechanical looking hands.
Yeah, metal hands.
Yeah, but
all the underwater stuff is really good, like getting from one part of the lab to another part of the lab or another part of the underwater facility. Underwater stuff is really, it feels really realistic in terms of like following the lights and feeling like a little bit lost, like, am I going the right way and stuff?
Oh,
and
then obviously you do stuff.
There's loads of that, yeah.
Yeah. But I guess the way it best demonstrates that, reveals the concept of what you actually are, is when you look in the mirror, like a bathroom mirror. I don't think you even have to, it's like an optional bit.
Yeah, you don't even have to do it.
You just look in the mirror and you realize the thing looking back at you isn't human, it's like a weird robot head. I can't actually remember what it looks like. It's like
a Wally head on a diver suit, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So obviously, you've got like hands. You've got like robotic hands and stuff. But you're kind of like, it's your consciousness in some sort of robotic exoskeleton thing.
Yeah, that's like, if there's ever a game that really, executed body horror, I feel like this game really does do it. It's all about like, his body isn't what he thinks it is, or his consciousness isn't where it should be, or where does it go after that?
There's so many interesting things to bring up here, and I guess we'll have to do this. We'll have to talk about some of the larger themes when you come to the end. But the next part, story wise, is you meet your major companion, right? There's a lady you've been talking to on the radio, and you reach the part of the base that she is in, and she herself is, she's on a computer screen. Although she has a human appearance on a screen, she is a consciousness on a computer, and she is aware of and comfortable that she is in a machine. And you move her to sort of your little PDA device that you have with you, and she becomes
start transferring people around. Yeah.
And there's lots of interesting conversations that happen with that as well, because she can't talk to you when she's in your PDA. She basically, you have a conversation with her and you get an objective, and then when you reach another area or another terminal, you plug her into that and then she can talk to you again. And then you have that conscious discussion with her even then, like, what is her reality when she's unplugged from something? Does she...
Yeah.
Where is she when she's not in anything that she can use to perceive the world? Yeah. It's very interesting. And you, and I guess this is where you find the mission, right? Where basically... your main character, Simon, is his name?
Yeah.
Simon, yeah.
Yeah. So Simon here gets the understanding of what happened. So basically, she gives you the background that the surface of Earth is uninhabitable after a comet strike. And what may be the very last people from... There's been no contact with the surface world. So for all intents and purposes, the people in those labs down in the bottom were... the last people on Earth. And the project that this lady that you've met, I'll have to look up her name in a moment, but
Catherine,
what Catherine was working on, her project that she was working on, the undersea lab, was almost a virtual reality where she felt that humans could live on without bodies anymore. Scans of people's brains, which she was taking from the rest of the crew down there, could be uploaded into this virtual mainframe, which will have a virtual world created in it, and they can exist in an arc thing, which could be launched into space. But everything went wrong, and things that they're not too clear on have gone wrong in the facility before it could be launched. So the arc is somewhere, and she wants you to recover it and help her launch it into space, and that becomes quite early on your objective, right?
In a weird way. Yeah,
that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
In terms of like the horror elements, though, there are these weird sort of visions / ghostly apparitions, or I guess it kind of feels like a ghost in the machine in some way that kind of stalk you in various areas.
Yeah.
Weird. How would you describe him? Disco ball head that follows in one particular area, and obviously there's not. Once it gets you, you kind of just pass out and then you wake up. But I think you only get like two chances once it gets you. But it's almost like if you look directly at it as well, it's more likely to come for you.
Everything glitches as well. If you look at it directly, your screen starts to glitch. It's a cool concept. I mean, like that element could be turned off. I don't know how that would work. Would they just not be there?
No, I played it with it off because I wanted to rush through it as quickly as I could. So I played it with the gameplay elements off. All the monsters are still there, but they don't kill you. So I could still play with, oh, there's a monster, I'm going to try and avoid that. And it gives you all the same advice, like, oh, don't look at it, or don't make a noise for the different mechanics. Mm-hmm. But basically there is no fail state. So if I'm playing it in that way and I absolutely fuck it and, you know, kick a load of tins of beans over or something and the monster comes, all that happens
God.
It comes up to you and goes, oogie boogie, and then walks off.
And then you've got no weapon as well. You've got no weapon, so there's no way for you to defend yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's pretty much just like run and hide, or wait for the creatures to just piss off, and then you can carry on doing what you're doing. And you know, it was really quite terrifying. There's a particular section later on where there's an enemy looks a bit different, looks a bit more monstery, I guess, rather than this weird sort of like glitchy. Strange. It looks a bit Silent Hill. It's kind of like a bag of skin with legs. And there was a particular moment in that where I was hidden and I was convinced that I'd got away with it, and then suddenly it just burst into the room and owned me. So I think that was a genuine scream as well. A genuine scream from me. I think it was more frustration than anything else, but fuck!
You have to go all the way back to that checkpoint.
I didn't really play with this element. Apparently you can throw stuff to distract the monsters. I just ran around.
I was trying to do that because, you know, I was trying to like get the experience of the game while trying to get through quickly. So you know the bit where you put the power breakers on, you've got to go and put some power on, and then you're in that room, you have to wait for it to warm up and then press the button, so you got to stay there for a little while. I was throwing like detritus across the room to try and get his attention and then creeping on back to the switch.
So, I mean, there's that horror element, but I mean, I think the reason this game is probably going to stay with me for a long time is the other horror element, which is all the suggested horror. Like, there's a bit where a part of the puzzle is you have to use a virtual terminal to create an instance of a virtual reality where there's two people or one person you're trying to get information from. His brain's been scanned at some point in the past. You've loaded him up. He thinks he's real. He thinks he's in a real world in a room. But as soon as something looks wrong to him, he starts to freak out and it crashes the system. So you have to keep loading him up over and over again, kind of like in a perpetual torture, until you manage to work out the puzzle and get him to give you the information that you need.
How you can do to keep him calm long enough to get the information out of him.
It was a bit like that episode of Black Mirror, the Christmas episode, where there's like that tiny little. Do you remember where John Hamm is questioning or trying to break? Yeah, yeah, the little egg thing, the little consciousness in the egg. It reminded me of that, where I felt like I've got too much power here.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm really like affecting somebody. Yeah, that was pretty intense.
And then, go on, sorry, Andy.
I was going to say, I think I asked you, Luke, did you pause for any of the like extra reading? Did you do that? Did you find that quiz at the end? Did it ask you the same number of questions over and over again? And did you change your answers at all?
Oh, I vaguely remember that because it says, when do you first answer it? A lot of questions are like, could you hurt someone? Or
the questions I had was, because it's all about this consciousness thing, and I guess we'll put this part of the story in now. So you, Simon, are there now because as part of their experiments, you were one of the first brain scans that was ever taken when they were first testing the technology. So your scan has been kept all of this time. As like a almost like, you know, like Alex Kidd on the Master System, right? This is the first. This is like the built-in version that they all had.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. Sorry. The hellhounds are breaking loose down there. It would appear. Without me tell them to stop, they're going to carry on for a minute or two. But yeah, so you were one of the templates that was first uploaded into the system. So this is how you somehow, by some happenstance, have ended up there 400 years in the future. But then, hang on a second, let me go and deal with this.
Okay.
So aggressive.
Yeah.
Let me go and deal with these little dogs. What point is this?
Okay. Well,
1 minute. 1 hour.
Yeah, 1 hour, 24 minutes. I've got, yeah. So what
back
about?
In action.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so where were you?
You were saying your mind was the first backed up, and you've been
you were the first back, and you've been in there this whole time. So this is now where you are. This is how you've ended up 400 years in the future. And I guess as a result, there are lots of questions you are asked, because as the Simon that had his brain scanned, he would have stood up back in 2000, whatever, and he would have carried on for the rest of his life. But you, the Simon that has woken up in the future, don't perceive anything that was past that. So you experience things and you are alive, but you are not the real Simon anymore. And that's what questions come up in the quiz. So the questions that it comes up for you are like, do you still feel like you're a real person? Do you feel that your life has more or less value than it did beforehand? How does it feel to be in this type of body? Do you mourn for the life you had and the body you had, or do you feel that you're a separate entity? And then it says, I think the last question is, do you wish to continue? And you could say, no, I would prefer to be dead. Yes, I'd prefer to be, I want to continue to be alive. And no, I think my life has more meaning now. Okay. Did you encounter any of those things?
I remember, but I don't remember what I put. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I did that twice. I think there was one at the end, post credits, and there was one a little bit earlier than that. And I think I changed my answers. I think in the post credits scene, I kind of tried to make my answers a little bit more like it was a happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so the bit that really hammers home this idea of instances of consciousness is when you need to go to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Is that the right word? Trench. But your flimsy robot body isn't going to be able to sustain it. So you build a body out of bits of suits and bits of robots or something. And then your colleague Catherine says, right, we're going to have to transfer your consciousness into the new body. So you do that. And it's a whole little furore, like you're zapped into this other body, and then you're suddenly in this other room where that body was, and you think, okay, it worked. But then you hear the you in the other room say, oh, nothing happened. I'm still in this body. And then it really hammers home the point that, oh, shit, it's not transferring any consciousness. There's no consciousness. Oh. They're just instances of minds that have been.
So you've copied and pasted, not cut and pasted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then
the old version of you needs to be basically, you get a choice whether you can switch him off.
Yeah,
that's what I did. I pulled his plug and because he was unconscious, and I let him go. And he have a couple of those choices as well, right? There's another bit where there is someone on life support, but you need the power to get through to the next one. So
I
yanked her out the wall. And then
get out! I need this. I think I sat there with her. She was like "Can you just sit here with me while I die?"
That's another one. I sat with her, but the one that I yanked out the wall was early in the game. But the other one that you mentioned, Ben, I did sit with her. She's the last true human, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I sat with her. Yeah. I was nice to her, and she asked me to do that. I wouldn't if she'd have said, "Oh, don't turn us off, mate." I wouldn't.
Yeah,
but she did ask me to.
Yeah.
So I sat with her.
Yeah, so I mean that like. I think is like a perfect in involving interactive story moment. Like it's so good. But Simon, for some reason, the main character is a bit of an idiot. He doesn't seem to realize because he said the same thing comes at the end. He thinks that at the end of the game, when he's launched this thing into space, this perfect utopia, that he's going to be on there. Like throughout the entire game, that's what you are aiming to do. Really, is to get yourself on there, a golden ticket. There's some great bits when you're on the bottom of the ocean floor where it's pitch black and you see like some giant whale beastie something just sort of swimming past you. It's amazing. And then you get towards the end. Is there any other moments? I guess there's lots of scary bits.
You by and large save the day, right? Because part of the reason there are weird monsters is because of the AI that has the ability with this like nanogel that it can basically construct things it's this stuff that is it's almost like biomechanical gunge and like almost like a parasite or a cancer that's growing out of control around the facility, which is why it's so weird and broken. It's why there are monsters.
And you also get the opportunity to bring that rat back to life. Did you do that?
I missed that bit.
It's like a dead rat, and then you can pull this lever and it squirts some of the gel on it. And it comes to life, starts like moving around.
Yeah, that was cool. I missed that bit.
Yeah,
but I think you get the opportunity to get rid of this thing, and you do, and you basically stop the further spread, and you poison it. So you've saved that thing, but then you're right, Luke. It all builds up to that end where you've technically saved this lab from just completely collapsing.
It's directed really well. That final moment where like the ships. It needs to get so much battery power or something for it to shoot off.
It's trying to transfer you, isn't it? So it's stalling.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, stalling. And you get Catherine up installed, and then it's like on about 70%, and it like just finishes off.
When it was doing that, I turned to Kat, my own Catherine, and I said, it's going to end with me stuck here on my own, isn't it? This is going to be like a little like bleak ending to it. But it works. The transfer completes, the ship goes into space, and then again Simon's like, I'm still here, it didn't work. And Catherine has to say, you don't get it. Like that there is a version of you up there, but you can't move you can't move your consciousness.
There's a conversation about it being like a 50-50 coin flip, I think they say like there's basically a toss of the coin, and your perception will be either the one that transfers, or it will be there are going to be two of you unavoidably, but whether you're the one that perceives that you've woken up in this new place, or you're the one that's still there,
is great because you're in pitch darkness, you're essentially like in an immortal body, or you're not going to die for a long, long time. You're kind of just stuck there. It has that bleak ending, which I'm a sucker for a good bleak ending, but it also has the nice ending as well. Like it does both, because a nice little moment at the end.
Although I was going to say that it gets even bleaker with your already bleak ending. The fact is that basically his celebrations turn from like the ultimate happiness into the realization that he is the copy that has been left there when they've been launched into space. And then he is so angry with Catherine, and he's shouting, and then she breaks, like because the thing that she's attached to breaks, so she's unable to speak to him anymore. So then he is entirely on his own, and you've already encountered other robots that have been down there on their own, and they've basically all gone mad. Yeah. So that's basically his fate, right? That he's down there at the very bottom of the sea at this point, where the only thing is that big horrible monster.
He's just been like buried. Yeah, it gets you. It really does get you. But we do get like a breath of fresh air in the end. We see the Ark is now in space, orbiting Earth, and then you have a nice little scene where you wake up and you go outside and it's all fresh air and it looks beautiful. It's like a nice sunny day, sort of idyllic, and you know, it's paradise. And I think you see Catherine up ahead, maybe, or something.
Yeah,
I'm not too sure.
She gives you a little wave. Yeah, you do. Yeah. You run over and say hello to her.
Well, yeah, amazing. Amazing ending.
Yeah. So well written. And there's so much. What is a short experience, say, like the mechanics are so simple that you can turn them on or off, basically. But there is so much rich content in there. And I think for the budget comparatively they must have had for this, there is so much that's gone into the writing and the creation of this entire world. So, you know, this, you know, the fictional technologies behind it, the setting, it all just falls into place so neatly.
Yeah, it's great. I remember starting to play it and being a bit like, no one really talks about it. No one really brings it up as one of the big hitters. But yeah, it's fantastic. Really great. Is there anything else we want to talk about before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I guess if anyone's listening to this and they want us to review a particular horror game or a particular horror franchise for a future episode, then just let us know.
Did anyone have any questions we need to go through? I know we answered Dan's about Resident Evil. Is there anything else we need to cover?
And if there are any other questions, a lot of people in the group kind of just mentioned horror franchises that they enjoyed and horror franchises that they've played. So stuff like Silent Hill was mentioned.
Silent Hill was the big one.
The PT demo, obviously Alien Isolation, which we've discussed, Outlast we've discussed. Edward Harvey mentioned Fatal Frame, which I played a little bit of. And Dan Taylor mentioned the Fear series as well, which I think I've played one of, maybe a PS3 one. But yeah, all stuff that we could possibly touch on in for future episodes. Maybe we should do something. I wouldn't mind doing something with Dead Space, potentially.
I'd like to play that.
I could go and finish Dead Space 3. I didn't get through that one, but 1 and 2 are great.
Can you run the PlayStation 4? Dead Space 1?
I don't know, I've got on PS3.
They're backwards compatible on Xbox, so I guess they'd work on one and then the other.
Cool, okay. I'm going to have a look. I want to play that. Cool. Yeah, this has been fun. We should do more. We always talk about games anyway. It's nice to have a bit of a chance to...
Yeah, nice to mix it up. So for next week, we were going to discuss Final Destination, which recently turned 20. Yeah. So yeah. Andy, you can join us for that if you fancy it.
Can we in?
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Yeah, so that was actually pretty cool.
Cool.
We've not done any early 2000s horror for a while, have we?
No.
I think so.
Come on. All right. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, you can become a patron over at patreon.com/hawkandcleaver. Thanks to Kovac Cameron for our theme music. Thanks to Acast for hosting the show. Thanks to the listeners. If you enjoyed the show, please consider rating and reviewing in iTunes. And remember to hit subscribe. Join the Facebook group, Horror Hangout Board of Advisors. And yeah, thanks to my co-hosts Ben and Andy. Nice one.
Thank you very much, guys. Luke. Thank you very much, Andy. Nice one. Yeah, guys. Until next time.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.